Wait, honey, pause for a second. What is he doing to that space whale? Welcome to the Spinal Frontier, where we speculate as to why Star Trek aliens are the way they are. I'm Kelly, she, her.
I'm Aaron, they, them.
So today we're continuing on with our life in space theme, I guess, that we started last week, or last episode.
Yeah, that's right. We talked about how the conditions in space affect the bodies of astronauts and what kind of hazards might befall our hypothetical Starfleet officers.
Yeah, and this week we thought we'd talk about the actual denizens of space, all of the non-human, non-humanoid, well, yeah, mostly non-humanoid organisms. No, they're all of the non-humanoid organisms that we find.
Yeah, all of the actual denizens of space in the Star Trek universe, the ones that can live out there in a vacuum without protection.
Yeah, yeah. And I have thoughts, I have feelings.
Well, so do we want to just jump right into it?
So there are so many different aliens. We're going to focus on a few, but there's so many different like alien species that are living in the vacuum of space, and they can all be considered extremophiles. Mm-hmm. So extreme meaning extreme, file meaning loving. So they're living in these really extreme environments that the average organism wouldn't survive.
Star Trek's X Games competitors,
I guess. So yeah, an extremophile is any organism that can survive and thrive in extreme environments. So there are so many kinds, and they range from like the tiny little hole munchers from that one episode.
Yeah, I feel like they can be divided into like three categories. One is like microscopic, or like they just look like dust, right? Two is
sentient dust.
Yeah, sentient dust. Two is space blobs. And so that's going to be your like Gormaganders, or your that one that looked like a big cuttlefish. That
those aren't blobs. Those are fully formed organisms.
Sure.
Complex yes. Organs.
They are. But they just don't look... Okay, maybe this is my bias. They don't look anything like a human.
Yeah. So, yeah, so non-human organisms, but...
Yeah, and then the third category would be things that are roughly human-shaped unless you look at them really hard. So, like, species 8472. It's got legs, it's got arms. Don't worry about how many of them, but...
Okay, so I think we're talking about, like, space invertebrates and space vertebrates.
Yeah, I think the space whales are vertebrates, though, maybe.
Yes.
Yeah.
So they're not blobs.
Yeah. I'm also thinking of that one that looks like, what do you call them? The shark egg sack?
Oh, yeah, mermaid's purses.
Mermaid's purses. There was a mermaid's purse that tried to mate with the Enterprise that one time.
Oh, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then whatever is, like, latched onto the nacelles of lower decks in the...
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
There's a lot going on in space, and... We may or may not in the Trek universe anyway, that we don't address. So I feel like it's more like space vertebrates, space invertebrates, organisms from another dimension.
Mm-hmm.
I think those are the three.
Okay.
In my head.
That makes sense.
Yeah. The larger orders of things. So we brought up Gormaganders. Tell the people who don't know what a Gormagander is.
So Gormaganders were introduced in season one of Star Trek Discovery. So if you haven't seen that show, they call it a space whale, but it really looks more like, it does look like a deep sea creature.
Yeah, it'd be like if a whale was a deep sea betta fish, almost. They're very, very fringy, very...
Yeah, like if the Demogorgon from Stranger Things didn't have arms or legs, but it did have a bunch of fins, and it just sort of hung out in space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do they eat? Like, what's their deal?
So in the show, they mentioned that they get their sustenance by feeding off of the alpha particles in solar winds.
Okay.
And I don't... Did we talk about alpha particles in our space radiation last week?
We didn't talk about alpha particles. We only talked about, like, waves.
Okay. Okay. I don't know enough about alpha particles to go in depth on it. But suffice it to say, it's a deep space radiation.
Okay. Yeah. When we were talking about kind of preparing this episode, I am so fascinated with how the Gormaganders got into space in the first place.
Yeah.
Because, as we kind of discussed before, developing a really large life form really depends on eons of evolution on a planet. And so my hypothesis is that Gormaganders came from a planet and developed in the sea of a planet. And I think that planet died and blew up. Because what's going to, like, if that planet just kind of, like, disintegrates or blows up, whatever, what is the thing that's going to, that's most likely to survive, like, an explosion? Like, if some meteor hit the planet or something and it just kind of cracked open and everything floated off into space, what do you think would be the most likely to survive, in my opinion?
My gut says nothing, probably.
I mean, no.
But if something were, maybe, like, So here's the thing is that some planets, like in real life, have evidence that they used to have volcanic activity and a rotating core, but they don't anymore. And so we know that a planet's core can kind of stop rotating and then you lose the magnetosphere, the protection of it. And so then the solar winds just sort of blow the atmosphere off slowly over millions of years. So maybe if there was life, something could have adapted to that lower pressure slowly over time. Mm-hmm. And then maybe when some Star Trek thing happened, when an episode of Star Trek happened and the planet finally blew up, this organism was maybe equipped for a vacuum better than others would have been.
Well, and if the atmosphere blows off, would there be time to adapt to getting these alpha particles as well?
Yeah, they would actually be exposed to solar radiation to a higher degree with less atmosphere to protect them. So yeah.
So they had their so long and thanks for all the fish moment, just like floated off planet.
Yeah.
And now they just float around space and they're considered an endangered species.
Mm-hmm.
I think technically in our in ecological parlance, when we're talking about conservation of animals, I think we don't have enough data on these animals to know whether they're endangered, because they are, like many earth whales, we just haven't come across enough of them to actually know the status of the species.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I think they say they're endangered on the show, though.
Yeah, but then they're also like, we've never seen one before. And so it's like, how do you know it's endangered?
I don't think that's Discovery's job.
No, but, it's not on any other... I swear there's space whales on something.
They mentioned Gormaganders in Lower Decks and in Star Trek Picard.
So it's really a new Trek invention?
Yeah, they were conceived for Discovery and then referenced in future shows.
Huh.
Yeah.
I think I might be thinking of something else.
I think what must have happened is that this is a charismatic animal, like a panda, that everyone knows about in the way they don't know about the mermaid's purse that the Enterprise had to give a C-section to. So, like, they're rare and you'll probably never, ever see one because you can't put one in a zoo. I don't even know if they have zoos in the 24th century.
Don't they like, they're going to like conserve it somewhere in the Harry Mudd short?
Yeah. Oh, it was a full episode. Oh. Yeah. They were going to take it somewhere. Wildlife refuge. I don't know.
Yeah. Something like, anyway. Yeah. I just have thoughts about space whales.
I think they're like space pandas. And here's why.
Well, I think they're like whales.
Superficially, sure. But so they mentioned that in the episode that they have to spend so much time eating alpha particles that they ignore their other instincts, and that includes reproduction. That's one of the reasons they're so rare, is because they're having this population crisis. And that reminds me of pandas who
have been trying to die for hundreds of years.
Who adapted to eat bamboo, which is not very nutritive.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to eat a lot of bamboo, and they spend a lot of time doing that. And so they forget to do other things.
So pandas are also still carnivores, and they do eat meat. They just mostly eat bamboo.
Okay.
It's not exclusive.
Yeah.
Because I've definitely seen a panda attack somebody at a zoo. So, like, they're definitely still carnivores. It's just...
Mm-hmm. Well, they are bears.
They are bears.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit more bamboo-focused. But, yeah, I understand what you're saying.
The Gormagander has eaten at least one hairy mud, so I will say that.
Factual, yeah. Yes. So they're not exclusively adapted, like they're not solo specialists on alpha particles. They do have some kind of omnivory.
They have a mouth. I believe there's teeth in the mouth.
Yeah.
So, and last I checked, alpha particles don't need to be chewed up. So those are either vestigial or they're snacking on something.
Or defense. Yeah, I think the Gormaganders have a lot of secondary adaptations or like stuff that's evolutionary holdovers because earth whales and other cetaceans, marine mammals, are all, it's called secondary, they're secondarily aquatic. Mm-hmm. So in biology, evolution holds that we all came out of an aquatic environment. We came out of the oceans as little flippy floppy vertebrates that grew, that developed limbs and developed the ability to permanently live on land. And there were some large mammals that made their way back into the ocean and re-evolved fins.
So they saw what was good on the surface and they said, no thanks, ain't for me. And they went back.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's relatable.
So they're secondarily aquatic, and I don't know what the term for a secondarily aquatic animal then going off into space. Tertiarily spacefaring? There's no word for that. Because we don't have anything that we know of that actually lives in space. So.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, so I just find it fascinating because I've taught a lot about how organisms interact with their environmental medium. So how we move through air and how marine animals move through salt water and other like freshwater fishes move through freshwater. And when you're moving through water and also through air, actually, how big you are relative to the particles of medium, so air molecules and water molecules, makes a big difference. And so for us walking through air, I imagine is kind of like whales swimming through water. Whales are so big that they just cut through water. It's not really a big deal. And the water kind of supports their buoyancy and so, or like keeps them buoyant. And so they kind of support their very heavy bodies. And so I can see how then going out into space where it is weightless, it's not going to get crushed. Its organs aren't going to get crushed by its sheer weight on dry land.
Yeah.
I could see how a Gormagander could get there. I could see how it could get there. Just because that's what the ancient history of a whale.
Especially if they've been adapting to lower pressures over millions of years while their planet's atmosphere.
Yeah, whales are meant to be buoyant. Whales are meant to be floating in something.
Yeah.
So
I still think if you put one in a vacuum, it would have a really bad time, though.
Theoretically, yeah. I wouldn't. I would love it for them.
We don't recommend doing this.
Yeah. No. I think a lot about the cetacean ops, like what it takes to get whales into space. And I think Star Trek IV is the only one that like...
Lower Decks.
Well, I guess now Lower Decks. I don't know. It's a whole thing. Just whales in space is very fascinating to me. Or whales evolving or whale-like organisms evolving too. Survive space and live like space pandas, I guess.
Well, they can already orient themselves three-dimensionally too. Yeah.
So we have other organisms to talk about, but first maybe let's take a little break.
Sure, yeah.
All right. So we gormagandered. There's another, like I want to briefly mention the tardigrade again. So there's the space version of a tardigrade, the Star Trek space version of a tardigrade, which is just a gigantic,
the size of a small bear,
the size of just a bear,
or like it's one pretty of those big. One of those smart cars.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, so like somewhere between a black bear and a grizzly, somewhere in there, maybe a brown bear size, and so it has many, many limbs, lots of plating that a normal microscopic tardigrade doesn't have, and they move around and interface with the supposed mycelial network because the theory is going such that fungus is pretty much everywhere. It's very hard to have a space devoid of fungus where there is life. So I guess they can follow a mycelial network, and that's kind of the whole basis of Discovery.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the mechanism for how Discovery develops a spore drive and such.
As I understand it, it's like a subspace pocket dimension.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they...
Full of mushrooms.
Full of mushrooms. Yeah. It is very trippy. Touché.
I cannot teach you about the mushrooms. You cannot kill them in any way that matters.
And again, but like, they're interesting, and I can see why they were kind of the first big, exciting creature that Discovery put forth.
Mm-hmm.
Because real tardigrades, Earth tardigrades, are known to be the most genetically unique organism on the planet.
Mm.
I think octopuses were the most unique for like 6 months, and then they finished publishing the tardigrade genome, and they're a little bit more unique. I think it's like 50%. They share 50% of their DNA with everything else on the planet. And for reference, like, we share 99.9, I think, of our DNA with chimpanzees.
Yeah.
So like,
those are really next closest relative. But how much do we share with a tree?
More than we do with the tardigrade.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a surprising fact.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's mostly like, hey, we don't make cellulose, more or less.
Not with that attitude.
Oh, God. Okay. No, we need to consume our dietary fiber. We can't just make it. Okay. So
more corn, everyone.
More corn. It has the juice. Anyway, so we've got the tardigrades that we've definitely talked about. I mean, there's all kinds of other little organisms, but one that we thought was particularly interesting to talk about is species 8472.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us about species 8472?
Yeah, so this is an alien from Star Trek Voyager that's native to an alternate dimension called fluidic space. They never got, like, a regular name for some reason, so they're just known by their Borg designation. And the Borg name every species they encounter
with a
serial number. And the reason they choose the numbers they do is unknown. You know, just Borg things. So yeah, we've got species 8472. They are a tripedal alien.
Mm-hmm. For reasons.
Yeah, so they've got three legs, but they only have two arms, which is interesting to me. And they can survive in a vacuum, which is... I find very interesting because they're from a dimension that's full of water. Well, it's not water, but like
fluid.
Yeah.
It's a denser medium.
Medium. So they live at a different pressure.
So they live at a different pressure, maybe, but you don't know what the density of that fluid is.
It's true. That's a really good point.
So that's my take on it, is like, they potentially live in some space fluid,
mm-hmm.
that, or some special
space juice.
Other dimension space juice. They have the juice. And it's possibly very light, and they just...
Yeah, I remember it looking like a dimension full of Mountain Dew.
Carbonation? They did the Dew.
Yeah, so these guys live in their pocket dimension where they do the Dew.
Yeah. So, yeah, my thought about that is that I'm not confident that they necessarily had to be in a high-pressure situation, because they're not in the same gravitational pull of having multiple atmospheres of pressure at depth. So, like we do, so if you go 33 feet down in the ocean, that adds an extra atmosphere's worth of pressure onto your body.
Yeah.
Like, that's why diving is dangerous. It's not just because you're swimming too deep away from air. It's like, hey, your body is undergoing these very high pressure changes, and you have to be very careful about changing pressure while too quickly in your whole body at the same time.
Right.
So yeah, it's interesting that this fluid, quote unquote humanoid, this humanoid shaped fluid can survive the vacuum of space. Because I'm just like, I'm guessing it's less dense, because if they can survive the vacuum of space and like not just kind of float apart.
Yeah. They're fine at one atmosphere of pressure as well, because they move around on Voyager and they don't
fluid,
seem upset by it.
Fluid is very hard to compact in like that form of matter. So it can probably withstand really high pressure if it needs to, just because, like, you can't compress water. That's a material property of water. It's hard to smush water molecules any closer together than they already are.
Oh, okay.
And that's the same with a lot of other fluids, is my understanding. So you can't really put fluid under pressure in that way and change its...
Kind of becomes a solid then, doesn't it?
No, because it would have to, like, crystallize somehow, or, okay, like, it changes its... So maybe if they... That would be interesting. So their dimension must be very cold, because the vacuum of space is very cold, generally, right? Like, it doesn't get hot closer to hot... Like, I'm guessing it gets hot closer to the sun, or to suns or stars, right? Like,
yeah, it's... space is an interesting thing, because hot and cold, it's hard to pin that down when you don't have an atmosphere as a medium, right? Yeah. But yes, space is both very hot and very cold.
Yes.
Simultaneously.
I'm assuming that the sun is kicking off.
It is, yes.
Like, high energy particles that would translate to heat.
So we recently went to a presentation on the James Webb Space Telescope.
We did.
Yes. And the person presenting was talking about the thermal layers between the telescope and the, like, just on the backside of it.
Oh, yeah. So
the sun. And it gets up to something like 187.
Like 600 degrees on the backside.
600 degrees on the backside. And then
negative
200 something.
On the telescope side.
Yeah. And I'm forgetting the units, but this is going to be either in Celsius or Kelvin.
It's
Celsius? Okay.
Yeah.
And so that's a big difference in temperature.
In a short distance.
In a short distance. So in response to, is space hot or cold? My answer is yes.
Anyway, that was my concern, just for, like, whatever. So these species 8472, probably.
90210.
C3PO VH1 PVQ. Yeah. Probably has a really low or really hard to attain freezing point or vapor point as well.
Yeah.
Like, they are extremophiles in that they have this huge range of environments that they can withstand without evaporating or freezing.
Yeah.
Or
they can also take
deforming.
Like a bunch of phaser shots. Like, they're really tough.
Yeah. It's a really interesting set of adaptations to be as fluid as possible. And you see fluidity as, like, we have fluid animals that aren't like, they don't hold a strong shape,
like octopuses.
No, I'm thinking more like jellies.
Oh yeah.
Or flatworms, I don't think
species 8472 is made of, like, well,
there's
so
no
we're
flesh
all, we're
it's
all,
really just fluid. Yeah,
no, we're, I mean, we're all made of fluid, but they're not like,
we're
jellyfish.
Like 50% fluid.
Yeah.
They're like 100% fluid.
I don't know about that. I think 8472, like, as far as I know, there's Meteor is the next creature.
Yeah, but it's just meat juice.
Maybe.
Because they're fluid? They're fluid organisms,
They're from
right?
fluidic space, but okay. I don't know if they're fluid organisms.
Oh.
Yeah.
Because I've been just basing all of this off of, like, they're also fluid.
Oh, not to my understanding. Because, like, they make bioships, which are organic spaceships, made out of basically the same stuff that they're made out of.
Well, that could just be auger, right? Like just goo. Mm-hmm.
But they also, like, infected Harry Kim with something too, and it
surprise
made him gooey, but, like, not fluid gooey, but, like,
fluid gooey.
Yeah,
just jelly. They jellied
him.
They
turned him into a human booger.
Ew.
Yeah.
Well, that means that they probably have some enzymes that, like, break down protein in order to keep them fluid, because that's something that we have, actually. We have things that are antifreeze for, like, maybe we don't have them, like, some extremophiles have them, that, like, deep sea ice fish have these antifreeze proteins that keep their body's fluids lower than, or, like, in higher solutions so that they don't freeze at those cold temperatures.
Yeah.
And we also have heat shock proteins that prop up our proteins when it gets too hot inside of our bodies as well.
Oh, okay.
So that's ways that extremophiles can deal with, like, extreme temperature, but I'm sure other things that affect your tissues, they have something on the cellular level that actually helps them with that. But yeah, that's about what I have for that, because I apparently don't actually remember what species A472 is. I did my homework really well.
Gosh. They're the ones, they had the war with the Borg, and Voyager had to team up with the Borg to push species 8472 back into their space.
Oh no, I'd forget.
And
they were
telepathic and also shapeshifters, because why not?
Well, yeah, because they're very fluid.
Yeah, okay. A fluid icon.
Fluid icons. 8472. Yeah. We'll probably have to come back to them at some point if they're telepathic, because we...
Yeah. Yeah, we want to do an episode on telepathy, right?
I'd very
right?
much like
yeah.
to talk about telepathy. Think,
so, like, next episode, I kind of want to keep going on extremophiles
yeah.
but specifically on the heat and cold end of the spectrum.
Oh, yeah, because we've got... hot aliens, we've got cold aliens, we have hot animals and cold animals. Those are fun to talk about as well, so we can talk about them and some more of their adaptations for dealing with that.
So just a teaser of what's coming up next episode.
Proteins. All right, well, if you enjoyed this episode, please rate us or share us on the social media. We would love to hear from you on the social media. I think I've been slacking on posting because I don't really hear from anybody who isn't our number one fan, Jeff. Hi, Jeff. So we'd love to chat more. And if you want to get a hold of us, you can look at Spinal Frontier Pod on Instagram or at Spinal Frontier on Twitter. And if you didn't like us, feel free to not say anything, because if you can't say anything nice, why say anything at all? Okay, honey, you can press play.